that I implemented was, as compared to previous incarnations of this course, is that I moved a section that used to be in the old lecture 12 now into an appendix to lecture 1. Namely, that section was to explain why it is okay in the process of quantization to essentially keep the equations of motion, just put hats over all the variables. There's really more to this story than simply saying that in the Heisenberg picture, the equations of motion stay the same. And that what is more to be said about this, I put a hat in lecture 12. Now, since it is very elementary and it doesn't really apply specifically to quantum field theory and curved space, I thought, let's put it right at the very beginning. Lecture 1, in any case, was relatively short. So in case you have not seen those arguments yet, they go back to Dirac, please have a look at the appendix to lecture 1 now, as it is online. And now that we have saved all that space, lecture 12 and lecture 13, so Thursday's and today's lecture, will be used to really go to the bottom of what it means to quantize a field theory on a generic curve background. So we finish this today, and then in the next lecture, we'll review Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes before we then go and quantize specifically on those and launch into cosmology and inflationary cosmology. So remember, remember that the free Klein-Gordon equation, the free Klein-Gordon field, and by that I mean a Klein-Gordon field without a potential, without a self-interaction, is quantized by solving these three sets of equations. The first set is simply the hermeticity of the field, expressing that classically the field was real number values. Then we had the set of equations that are the equal time commutation relation. And finally, we have the equations of motion, the Heisenberg equations of motion, which in the case of the free Klein-Gordon field, reduced to those two equations, the relationship between pi and pi, sorry, and the Klein-Gordon equation. It is important that the potential vanishes here. On the basis of the last lecture, do you have an idea why it was crucial that, unfortunately, we had to set the potential equal to zero? What would have gone wrong? Any idea? Well, you see, what would have gone wrong is this. The space of solutions wouldn't be a linear space anymore, because in the presence of a potential, let's say it's phi to the fourth potential, you would have that the equation of motion has a phi to the third term in. And that means that if you have one solution to the Klein-Gordon equation and another solution, the sum of the two is not going to be a solution. So it's very important that we drop the potential term. Fortunately, in inflationary cosmology, we seem to be getting away with that, because all the non-triviality comes from the background. So in principle, last time we succeeded in solving those two equations, those three sets of equations. The hermeticity conditions, the commutation relations, and the equations of motion, by making a particular answer. But if you review what we did, you will notice that actually we haven't completely solved those three equations, or at least we haven't shown yet that we really completely solved them. What we did show is that the ansatz that we make solves the first set of equations. Hermeticity is built into it right away. Also, the equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, was obviously true because we built our ansatz with classical solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation multiplied with constants. So definitely that was also true. And then we struggled with the canonical commutation relation. We eventually showed that if you make a choice for a space-like hypersurface in space-time, then you can actually, with our ansatz, arrange for the canonical commutation relations to hold on that space-like hypersurface. So for that definition of simultaneity. But the trouble is, we only showed it for one space like hypersurface. We really have to convince ourselves that our ansatz really succeeds, which means that if we if we have the canonical commutation relations hold at one time, which is to say on one space like hypersurface, that it will really that they will really always hold on all space like hypersurfaces. And that's not obvious. So we made this ansatz, namely that the field operators as a function of space and time can be written in this way, where the UK are complex number valued functions of space and time that solve the classical Stein-Gordon equation, and the A and the A dagger are operators obeying this commutation relation. And phi was related to phi in this way by definition, which made sure that one of the equations of motion held by construction. Well, and we simply plugged this ansatz into the commutation relations to check whether they would hold. And we showed that if we pick a space like hypersurface, sigma, then we can always find a set of mode functions, a set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equations, such that the canonical commutation relations do hold on that space like hypersurface. But there was no guarantee as yet that the same set of mode functions would make the canonical commutation relations hold not only on sigma, but on all space like hypersurfaces. And the problem is serious. In principle, you might say, well, maybe I should be modest and be happy with just obeying the canonical commutation relations on one space like hypersurface. Maybe it's not so bad if things go a little bit off the rails. Maybe, maybe, you know, how do we know that the canonical commutation relations really have to be conserved? Now here, with this remark, I want to make the point that really everything would go wrong if the canonical commutation relations were not preserved. And you can convince yourself of that by seeing that non-conservation of the canonical commutation relations would actually imply non-unitary time evolution. But non-unitary time evolution is really bad, because it means that probabilities are not conserved. Even if the sum of probabilities adds up to one, now it may not in the future. And that really would screw up all attempts at interpreting the outcome of any calculation. How do we see that, that non-conservation of the canonical commutation relations would imply non-unitary time evolution? Well, we can see that by proving the reverse direction. We prove that unitary time evolution implies conservation of the canonical commutation relations. Logically, it's the same statement. So as always in quantum theory, the time evolution operator, which we can write in this way. Remember that if the Hamiltonian is time dependent, and in general it may be, in our case it's not, perhaps, but in general we will allow that it is time dependent, then we have here a time ordering operator. This time evolution operator in any case is always a unitary operator. So its adjoint is its inverse. The time evolution operator allows us, as always in the Heisenberg picture, to write an operator at a late time t as this function of the same operator at an earlier time t naught. Simply apply the time evolution operator to the left and to the right. And the same for any observable, including the canonically conjugate momentum field. Now assume we know what the commutator is between phi and pi, and that it really is as it is supposed to be. It's obeying the canonical commutation relation. Then let's see whether phi and pi at a late time will obey the canonical commutation relation, assuming that we have unitary time evolution. Well, let's see. Here's the commutator between the fields at a late time t. We express phi using the fact that the time evolution is unitary, and we express phi using that the time evolution is unitary. Remember that so far we don't know that yet. Our ansatz has not been shown to guarantee unitary time evolution. But if the time evolution is unitary, then phi at late time is that, and pi at late time is this. But you see, when you write that out, those inverse u's eat up the u's. And that means that the only surviving time evolution operators in this are really one time evolution operator to the left and one inverse to the right of the commutator. But the commutator is a delta function or delta distribution, and as an operator, that's a trivial thing. So therefore, this eats up that, and we have just what we ought to have. So that means that if the time evolution is unitary, then the canonical commutation relations must be conserved. And that means that if we allowed for non-conservation of the canonical commutation relations, we would have to violate unitarity. So we'll have to take this seriously. So we make this proposition. If our answer solves the commutation relations at one time, and we've shown that already in lecture 12, that is, if on one space-like hypersurface sigma, then it automatically also solves the commutation relations at all other times, which is to say on all other space-like hypersurfaces sigma prime. Let us prove this. In order to show this, what we have, it suffices to show that the value of this symplectic form is independent on the space-like hypersurface on which we evaluate it. Remember how we proceeded to show that the commutation relations can be fulfilled on the space-like hypersurface sigma in the last lecture. We defined this symplectic form. It is anti-symmetric in V and F. And then we relied on Darboux's theorem to tell us that this symplectic form can always be put into a special form, which looks as if it was nearly diagonal, but it had minus ones and plus ones close to the diagonal. And that was for real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Then we switched to complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation and defined an inner product for them, which turned out to be in Hermitian form, a Hermitian form. We were able to diagonalize that and get an orthonormal basis of the function space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And that basis, it turned out, is giving us a solution to our problem, a solution to the canonical commutation relations when we put them into the answer. So everything will work out completely independently of which space-like hypersurface we choose, if only we can show that this is actually independent of which space-like hypersurface you use in order to integrate this. But remember what this thing does. You take two real number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, F and G. And they are functions of space as well as of time. And you plug them into this expression here. And this is still a function of space and time. And then you integrate it over a space-like hypersurface, a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface in four-dimensional space. And you obtain a number. If that number, and therefore this entire symplectic form, if that is independent of where you integrate, of which space-like hypersurface you choose, then the rest will go through. And the solution to our problem of the quantum field theory that we obtain for one sigma is good for all sigma. So that's the task now. We have to show that this expression here is independent of sigma. This illustrated visually in this way. Imagine time flows to the right, and imagine that the three space dimensions, which may be curved, flow upward, up and down. To express that what we mean by equal time is relative, and you have a lot of choice in this, I put some wiggles into this. Okay, so this is one space-like hypersurface, So this is a three-dimensional thing, three-dimensional space-like isosurface in four-dimensional space-time. 2 by 2 cos sigma. And this is another space-like isosurface that we may call a sigma prime. So all those points here have the same time coordinate. We call them equal time. And also those, among another, have the same time in a suitable coordinate system. Then we need to show that integrating this expression over that hypersurface equals the same number as integrating it over that hypersurface. Let us analyze the integrand. So we're integrating this thing here. And that looks like a part that belongs to a volume form. Whereas this is a contravariant vector, right? I mean, just this bracket alone is a covariant vector field with the G mean U that is a contravariant vector field. Just let us give this thing a name. Let's call it J mu. Some people would call it a current because, as we later show, it will be divergence free. And that is often a property of current. But better not think of a current because this is not about particles flowing through surface. It's just a mathematical similarity. So let us give this piece of the integrand a name. Let's call it the contravariant vector field in J mu. Now, what about the rest of it? Ultimately, we need to integrate this thing over a three-dimensional hypersurface. Now, those of you who took my course last term, I expect to know all about this. And the others are excused, perhaps, for the next 10 minutes or so. So this is a contravariant vector field. We need to integrate over a three-dimensional hypersurface. Though, so ultimately, we need to turn this into a three form in order to be able to integrate it over a three-dimensional manifold. Remember that P forms can be integrated over p-dimensional manifolds. So what can we do in order to turn a contravariant vector field into a three form? Well, what we do is we take the volume form, which is a four form. It's the only canonical four form that we have. So omega is the volume form, which, if you remember, is square root of the absolute value of the determinant of G times d4x. We take the volume form. And remember, it's a fourfold covariant tensor. It feeds on four contravariant vector fields. Well, we feed it one of them. We feed it J. And that, if you remember, is called the inner derivation. So we apply the inner derivation in the direction of J onto the volume four form. And that gives us a three form, which we may call J tilde. So our symplectic form now simply is this. The integral over a space-like hypersurface, over a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface, over that three form, which is the inner derivation in the direction of J of the volume. Now, let us integrate over both space-like hypersurfaces at once. In principle, the two space-like hypersurfaces, sigma and sigma prime, can be very far separated from another. In principle, this could be a much earlier time than that. Remember, this is all equal time. That is all equal time. And the time between the two could be very large. However, at space infinity, at spatial infinity, we can always ask our space-like hypersurfaces to meet. And we can do that because we can assume that the fields don't contribute, that the fields themselves, the F and the G, the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, would be very small out there at infinity. But it's a very useful trick to bring these space-like hypersurfaces together at infinity, because then these two surfaces actually enclose a volume. Let us call this volume B. So the boundary of B is the union of sigma and sigma prime. And the whole point of doing this is, of course, that we can then apply Stokes' theorem that relates integrals over boundaries to integrals over volume. So B is a four-dimensional space-time volume. Sigma is a three-dimensional space-like isosurface, and sigma prime is as well. So then, Stokes' theorem tells us that the integral of J tilde, this free form, over sigma, as well as over sigma prime, which is to say we integrate over the boundary of the enclosed region B, and a common notation for boundary of a region is del B, is the same in our case as sigma union sigma prime. That integral is the same, according to Stokes, as the integral over the bike here and the exterior derivative of our three form, this being a four form, of course. Right? If this is a three form, then the exterior derivation applied to the three form is a four form, and four forms can be integrated over four-dimensional manifolds. So from Stokes' theorem, we have that. But one thing you need to keep in mind, too, is that, well, we'll get to this in a moment. So if we can now show that perhaps dj tilde is zero, if it turns out that j tilde is a closed form, or in more physics-oriented language, is a conserved current, if we can show that, then we're done, actually. And that's because if this is zero, then the right-hand side is zero, which means that this integral is zero, but it consists of two contributions, an integral over sigma and an integral over sigma prime. So we have that zero is equal to the integral over sigma and sigma prime over our current form. And this is the integral over j tilde of j tilde over sigma plus the integral of j tilde over sigma prime. Now you may wonder, well, but that's the sum of the two. Doesn't that mean that the integral over this surface is the negative of the integral over that surface? Because the sum of the two overall is zero. Now that's not quite so, because when you do Stokes' theorem, then you're integrating over the boundary, and you can view this as integrating always outwards. The vector j is always contributing to the integral positively if it's pointing outwards from the surface. And that would mean that it's past pointing for sigma and future pointing for sigma prime. So if we turn around that definition of what is contributing positively and what is contributing negatively to the integral for sigma, then we actually obtain opposite signs for the two contributions. And we're actually evaluating them the same way, because then in both cases, we have the J, the current future pointing, which is what we should always do. So once we flip the integration direction to future pointing in both integrals, then we have that zero is equal to minus the first integral plus the second integral, so the two integrals are really the same. And that means that the integral over our J tilde on a space-like hypersurface is independent of that choice of space-like hypersurface. So we are actually done. We actually showed that the symplectic form is independent of the space-like hypersurface. Wait a moment. In the middle of a sentence, we are done with it if we can show that this is really vanishing, right? So we are done if we can show that this is really a closed form. Yes?
How did you obtain this form like this?
Okay. So J is a contravariant vector field. And the inner derivation of the volume form with respect to the contravariant vector field is a three form. So in order to complete the proof now that quantization is always possible using our ansatz, at least for globally hyperbolic spacetime, all we need to show now is that the exterior derivative of our three form really vanishes. Right? So let us call the, let us calculate the exterior derivative of the three form. Where is the exterior derivative of the inner derivation of omega in the direction of J, which, if you remember, at least those of you who took my course last term, I expect to remember, this is the divergence of J with respect to the volume form omega, which concretely is this. It's square root of G times J mu, and then you contract with the mu. Remember that this gives us a square root of G in front of the J mu. The J mu didn't have a square root of G, even though the symplectic form. So concretely, and this means that we have to evaluate that. We have to show that this is vanishing, right? So the derivative of J is this times the this four form, and this whole thing is going to vanish if this prefactor is going to vanish. So let us look at this prefactor. We're differentiating here square root of G times J mu. Let us write it out. It's square root of G times this. This was the definition of J mu, if you remember. This is how we defined the J mu. And we have to differentiate this, all of that, and all of those terms are functions of space and time. We have to differentiate them with respect to the x mu coordinate and sum over mu. Now, if we're not careful, we end up with a huge mess of terms. So let us be clever about this. What we'll do is this. We will differentiate. Let's look at this first term here. It's really the product of two terms. One term is square root of G, G mu nu, D mu G, and the other term is the F. Okay? Now, if we when we differentiate with respect to mu by the product rule, we differentiate the first term, leave the second the same, plus vice versa, the usual Leibniz rule. And we apply the usual Leibniz rule for these two terms, for square root of G, G mu, D mu G, it's one factor, and the other factor is F. Right, let us work out the derivative from this. Gives us two terms there. One term is obtained by differentiating F and leaving the rest the same. That's this term here. You see, the rest is the same, square root of G, G mu, D mu G, and all we've differentiated is F, D mu F. But then we also get a term where we leave the F the same and differentiate the rest. So we can pull the F out, and then we have square root of G, G mu nu, D mu G, and all of that is to be differentiated with respect to mu, with respect to X mu. And we do just the same thing over here, where either we differentiate with respect to G, or we differentiate with respect to the rest. Then we get those two terms with minus time. And we notice that these two terms are the same. So I'm crossing them out and put the same number here and there to indicate that those two terms cancel another out. By the way, that's just a useful notational trick. When you have long equations and a lot of terms are canceling each other, then it's good when you cross them out against another, when you have them cancel each other, that you put a number on the same number on those bars that slash terms that cancel each other, because then it's much easier to reconstruct what you did, if you want to check what you did, which you always should. So those two terms cancel another, and we're left with this thing. They look messy. So all we have to differentiate here, those three terms with respect to x mu. But it turns out that it's just the right type of term that we get a tremendous simplification. And that's because the Klein-Gordon equation can be recognized in here. Remember the Klein-Gordon equation. Can you see that in the back? So here's the Klein-Gordon equation, the D'Alembert operator. On curved space-time, the D'Alembert operator looks like this. 1 over square root of g, then open the bracket, square root of g, g mu, d mu phi, and comma mu. This p, except for the prefactor of 1 over square root of g, this p is exactly what we have over here. Isn't that nice? So that means that this piece, complicated thing, can be replaced by, well, this times the inverse of that and the minus sign. So this piece, by the Klein-Gordon equation, and remember that the G and the F are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We work in the vector space of real valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. So we can replace this expression in G by that expression, minus m squared g square root of g. That's what it is.
You should use the same thing as g for
that. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, this is the function here.
Okay, and the same thing we can do with f, which is also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, so you see where this is going. This term and that term actually, when you write it out, they are just the same. So indeed, the divergence of this vector field is really zero. So therefore, we finally proved that indeed, at least for globally hyperbolic spacetimes, there always exist mode functions, uk of x and t, so that our answers for phi and pi, in terms of creation and annihilation operators, not only gives us a solution to the hermeticity conditions at all times and the equations of motion at all times, but also the canonical commutation relations at all times. Which is to say that there's always a set of solutions, a set of classical solutions, classical complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that this expression is that at all times. Remember, that was the equation that we were struggling with, the equation that we called Ri. Remember how this came about? We had an ansatz for phi in terms of a sum of mode functions times A and A dagger operator. And that gave us also an ansatz for pi hat, in terms of A and A dagger operator. When you write down the commutator between the phi and the pi, where phi and pi are expressed in terms of the ansatz with the A and A dagger operator, then the statement that the canonical commutation relations for phi and pi hold means this statement for the mode functions. Remember? That was just a two-line proof, really. So this thing has to hold at all times. And then we said that we could imagine that this sort of thing would hold in the case of Minkowski space, where the mode functions were simply plane waves. But it was highly non-trivial to show that you can always find solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that these things would sum up to a delta function in general. See, if this is plane waves, then you can imagine that it works out using Fourier theory. And in fact, it does. Let me just illustrate that. Remember that we had early on in this course obtained the solution of the quantum field theory on Minkowski space. And it looked like that. The Hermitian operator valued field as a function of space and time can be written in this way, where omega k is square root of k squared plus m squared, k vector squared plus m squared. From this, we can read off what the mode functions are. So the mode functions are simply everything in front of A, and the complex conjugate of that is, of course, everything that is in front of the A dagger. So the mode functions, the uk of x and t in the case of Minkowski space, with those functions. See, this thing is what multiplies the x. So let's see whether those mode functions really do the trick. So if we take those mode functions and plug them in this complicated condition here, do we really get the delta function? Well, things simplify because a Minkowski space, the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of V is 1, and G naught mu is simply delta naught mu. Therefore, this expression here simplifies. We don't have a sum over mu anymore. It's just the time derivative that occurs in here, and that's just the 1. So the left-hand side of that equation here, the left-hand side is this, becomes, in terms of this mode function from Minkowski space, this lengthy expression here, where the time derivative simply pulls down factors of I omega k from those time dependencies here in this plane wave. These things nicely combine together, and we simply end up with that. But the integral over all plane waves is, by Fourier, really just the delta function. So in this case, things add up very nicely. But we have shown now that this actually always works. Not through Fourier, but in general, it just always has to work out, because we showed that this equation Ri, this one, always reduces to a resolution of the identity in the solution space of the Klein-Gordon equation. All right, so where are we so far? Well, to solve the quantum field theory of a free Klein-Gordon field on a curved spacetime is to solve the hermeticity conditions, the equations of motion, and the canonical commutation relations. We made this solution ansatz here, where if we implement an infrared cutoff, we can put a sum. In general, we may have to put an integral over a complete set of mode functions, set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, that is, complex value solutions, multiplied with A and A Dagger operators. And we showed that at least if spacetime is globally hyperbolic, then there actually exists a set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, UK, so that this ansatz A solves the hermeticity conditions, the equations of motion, and the canonical commutation relations for all time. Now, that was only a proof of existence. It didn't exactly tell us how to get those solutions. And it didn't tell us whether there is really only one solution. So let's ask, is it unique? In the case of Minkowski space, we didn't seem to have much choice. Actually, we did have. We just didn't make use of it. It turns out that actually, by the method that we applied, we find that there is actually an infinity of possible solutions that will do it. There's not just one set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that will have this property that this ansatz obeys these three conditions. There's an infinity of such sets which will do it. And to pick out which ones to use will take up a lot of time in the next few lectures. So indeed, there actually exist many such sets of solutions. And why would that be? Why is it that our procedure for proving that there are such solutions gives us a non-uniqueness of the solution? Remember how we went about it. We looked at this symplectic form. Just a few minutes ago, we proved that it's independent of the space-like hypersurface. We took that symplectic form. And then we made use of a theorem of Darboux, which says that there exists a basis of real valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And that space is called V, in which this symplectic form takes, with respect to which this symplectic form takes this form, where on the diagonal it's zero, but then the next to the diagonal is 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, and the rest is 0. So it's lots of little boxes, of 2 by 2 boxes, which are 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and then there's another box, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and so on. So there are pairs of solutions such that this looks like that. And this was the next best thing after diagonalizing a self-adjoint operator. Now, remember that when you have a self-adjoint operator, its diagonalization is unique. Well, except if you have a degeneracy of eigenvalues, because then in the eigenspace for one eigenvalue, you have choice of bases. But other than that, for a self-adjoint operator, there's really no choice. It has one diagonalization, and that's it. But here we found that for this anti-symmetric thing here, for the symplectic thing, it's not like that. Or we will find now that it's not like that. There is a basis such that, with respect to this basis, this symplectic form takes this shape. But it's not the only basis. There are plenty in which the symplectic form takes this shape. And that's important because from these pairs of Vn, you know, the pairs that have this box here, from these pairs of Vn solutions, we constructed the complex solutions Un as V2n plus I V2n plus 1. And the complex solutions are really the mode functions that go into the answers. Right? The phi of x is complex number valued solution times a n plus un star a n dega. But now we will see that actually these Darboux bases are far from being unique. We can see that by looking even only on a two-dimensional subspace. Of course, we can also mix in between those, but even if we just look at the two-dimensional situation of having just one of these boxes, we already see an ambiguity. Namely, as an example, take a two-dimensional solution subspace, two of those solutions that have a box in them. So V1 and V2 are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that form such a Darboux pair. So that's the subjective form with respect to these two basis vectors is this. So any vector in this two-dimensional subspace is a linear combination of V1 and V2. And the coefficients of any two such vectors have this inner product, or have this subjective form. Now let's see, can we change bases in this two-dimensional space? Can we go from vectors V1 and V2 with respect to which the subjective form takes this form? Can we go to another basis, which we may call V1 bar and V2 bar, such that with respect to this new basis, the symplectic form also takes this shape? If it does, then we can take this new basis just as well as the old one, build U and U star complex value solutions out of them, and the whole solution program to the quantum field theory will go through too. So can we do this? Well, let's see. From linear algebra, we know that if this is a matrix, an endomorphism, and we change basis by a change of basis matrix B, so we go from vectors V bar I to vectors V I using this change of basis, then the shape of the matrix changes by applying B transpose and B to the left and to the right. So the question of uniqueness or non-uniqueness of a Darboux basis boils down to the question whether there are matrices, 2 by 2 matrices B, invertible 2 by 2 matrices B, such that B transpose applied to that matrix B is the same matrix again. But under change of basis, the shape of the matrix doesn't really change. Well, you can convince yourself. It's a very simple calculation. And please do it in your spare time at some point. That, in fact, any matrix B will do as long as its coefficients A, B, C, D have the property that AD minus BC is 1, just to say that its determinant is 1. So any SL2R matrix, any special linear transformation will do. Any linear transform with determinant 1 will actually keep that the same. Obviously, there are plenty of them, which means that there are plenty of double bases. So that means we actually have, seems to be, too many solutions. At first, we were worried. Can we ever arrange for our unsets to work? Can we ever find a set of number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that our unset solves not only the equations of motion and the hermeticity, but also the Klein-Gordon, but also the commutation relations at all times? And now we find that yes, there's an infinity of possibilities, which means that we can find a solution phi hat of x and t by using one set of number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, multiply them with operators ak plus complex conjugate a dagger k, etc. But then let's choose another double basis, and then we can find the solution to our problem, phi hat of x and t, expressed in terms of this new, this other solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, which corresponds to a different choice of double basis. And then we, we have a different solution, really. Similarly, can choose another set of another double basis, another set of complex number valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and so on and so on. It would seem that there's an infinity of ways of solving our quantum field theory. And each time we do it, we seem to get a different set of Fock vectors. You see, here we have mode functions u raising along operators a and a dagger. So we have that a is annihilating some vector in Hilbert space, which we may call 0. And then we can build states on top of that by applying the a dagger operator n times on this. We already showed that in this way, you always get an orthonormal basis of vectors. But alternatively, we can work with those other expressions, find a zero bar operator that's annihilated by the a bar operators, and then build this ON basis on top of that, and so on and so on. In other words, we get a lot of candidates for what we may call eventually a ground state or a vacuum. Well, we're not there yet. Let's just say it's operator, it's vectors that are being annihilated by either this annihilation operator or that one or that one. So this raises the question, do these solutions of the quantum field theory describe different physics? Which they might, like a priori, if you have different solutions, they might describe different physics, right? I mean, it could be that this describes a horse and not an elephant. I mean, it could be really different. Or could it be that they do describe the same physics? And that would be if, that would be the case if actually, maybe this is exactly the same as that. And the only way in which they differ is a change of basis in the Hilbert space. Now, don't mix up the Hilbert space of state, the Fock space. Don't mix that up with the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. That's a different thing, right? The space of solutions in the Klein-Gordon equation, V or its complexification V bar, was one thing. we chose an order number basis in there. These were the U and the U star and so on. But here I'm talking about the Hilbert space, the quantum mechanical Hilbert space of states, the thing that is spanned by this zero vector and the vectors n and so on. So what could be is that this is in fact exactly the same solution as that to the quantum field theory. And the only way in which they differ is a change of basis in the Hilbert space. It could be that all those vectors are simply linear combinations of those vectors. Okay? And it might just be that all we have to do is some change of basis from one orthonormal basis to another, in which case it would be a mere matter of convenience whether you work with this way of writing our solution, or you choose some other mode functions, let's say those, and you write our solution to the quantum field theory problem in this way. So what is it then? Any guesses? really? Somebody read ahead. Okay. Right, it depends. Well, let's first assume that we can impose infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs. So let's assume that we can put a cutoff on the size of the system. Might be as big as the Milky Way or halfway across the universe or whatnot. But in any case, we can put a long distance cutoff on this theory. And let's assume that we can also put an ultraviolet cutoff on the theory, meaning that we can neglect the contributions from wavelengths smaller than a certain wavelength. And what do I mean when I say that we can impose those cutoffs? Can't we just always impose them? Well, the question is, if you impose them, do you incur a mistake that you cannot or can correct? You see, if we can impose infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs, I mean by that, we can put those cutoffs, and yes, we will incur some mistakes, but by making the cutoff for the infrared very, very large, and the cutoff for the infrared very, very small, then the error should go arbitrarily small. But it may be that those limits are not safe. It may be that in certain circumstances, we're not allowed to take those limits. And I'll get to such circumstances in a minute. So let us assume for the moment that it is safe, that we can put long distance cutoffs. We put our system into a box and put periodic boundary conditions, for example, and we neglect all wavelengths shorter than a certain wavelength without damaging the theory qualitatively. So as long as we cut off at extreme enough scales, the error that we make should be arbitrarily small. Well, let's assume that this is so. Well, then this means that we are actually truncating our quantum field theory to a finite number of mode oscillators, An and An dagger. Okay, because we put an infrared cutoff, we made sure that our answer doesn't have an integral. It has only a sum of mode functions. So it's a discrete set. And by putting an ultraviolet cutoff, we made sure that there are no arbitrarily small wavelengths. So actually, there's a cutoff for large k or for large n. So we end up having just a finite number of independent mode oscillators. Now, that number may be tremendous. I don't care. It could be 10 to a million. But it's finite. And if it's finite, then a theorem applies. And that theorem is due to Stone and von Neumann. And what they showed is that in this case, you can only have a change of basis. The solution is unique, and any two solutions can only differ by a choice of basis. Concretely, what they showed is that if you have one set of canonically conjugate observables, xi and pj, and they obey the canonical commutation relation, and I is running from 1 to capital N, where capital N can be arbitrarily large, but finite. And assume that you have another set of canonical commutation relations, obeyed by another set of operators X tilde. And you assume that these representations are irreducible. And you assume that you can exclude pathological cases, and I will get in a moment to what that means. Well, then you can show that there is a unitary operator U such that the tilde operators are simply a change of basis described by U of the untilded operators. So the representations of the canonical commutation relations are really the same. They only differ by a change of basis. Now, the pathological cases arise because those operators, you see, it sounded as if it were, it probably sounded to you as if it were all well-defined, what I just said. But it's not really, because operators that obey these commutation relations cannot be bounded operators. Technically speaking, they cannot be bounded operators. And that means several things. It means that they cannot be continuous, and it means that they cannot be defined on the entire Hilbert space. These things cannot be defined on an orthonormal basis, for example. So therefore, when we were talking on talking about change of basis, we really have to put a lot of disclaimers onto this. Now, you can avoid these subtleties by switching from operators X and P, which are unbounded, to operators e to the power of I alpha X and e to the power of I beta P. And then working with their commutation relation, you can show that they really are independent of the choice of basis, or any irreducible representation is equivalent to any other irreducible representation up to a choice of basis. Now, what is better about this than the actual operators X, hat, and P hat? Well, what's better about those is that these are unitary. And unitary operators are bounded, they're continuous, and they're defined on the entire Hilbert space. So you can have them actually act on a Hilbert basis, for example, on an orthonormal basis in Hilbert space. But I don't think it's worth going into the subtleties of this too much. Now, if we apply this to our quantum field theory, what do we have? Well, we have A and A dagger operators, plenty of them. And we can define, just for the heck of it, just for this particular application of Sohn and von Neumann, we can define operators X hat and P hat. Don't think of them as positions and momenta. Just think of them as operators that obey the canonical commutation relations, simply by virtue of the fact that the A and the A daggers do. They have the usual Kronecker delta commutation relations. Therefore, the so defined X and P have the usual IH bar delta NM commutation relations. So therefore, the theorem of Sohn and von Neumann implies that whether we work with mode functions U and creation annihilation operators A and A dagger, or whether we work with mode functions U bar and creation annihilation operators A bar and A bar dagger, doesn't matter, because we can always find a unitary transformation in the Hilbert space such that these things go over into another. They really just differ by a change of phase, which means that these bases that we construct, remember, when we solve the quantum field theory this way, then we construct a basis of vectors, the first one being this vector that's annihilated by the AK, and then all of those vectors. These basis vectors, well, each of these basis vectors is a linear combination of those basis vectors and vice versa. It's not obvious just yet which linear combination they are, but ultimately, as you can already see, perhaps we'll have to calculate these things. And it may remind you of the study of the driven harmonic oscillator, where we also had an in and an out ground state. And on the in ground state, we built excitations. On the out ground state, we did. And in this way, we were able to calculate what happened in the Heisenberg picture during the time of the loop. Now, the second possibility is that we cannot get away with imposing an infrared or ultraviolet cutoff. There could be many different reasons. For example, we may not be able to put an ultraviolet cutoff in there, because if we do, we may be missing something very important from Planck scale physics, from quantum gravity. In principle, we cannot exclude this. It could be that some phenomena of very, very, very short distances actually propagate to large distances as well and affect them. We normally don't expect this. We expect that we have what is called separation of scales, that what happens at tremendously small scales shouldn't really matter so much for the large scales. Basically, you can study ocean currents without knowing how the hydrogen, how the water molecule looks like. You don't really need to know about the tiniest details of what's going on at small scales in order to cover the large scale. So we expect that similarly, waves in quantum fields of long wavelengths would be just like ocean waves, not caring about what really happens at extremely small distances. We can't be sure. We know, for example, that turbulence is a phenomenon that mixes scales from very small scales to very large scales.
We don't know what happens to the planck scale anyway. I don't see any other point in including it anyway. If we just try to include it in our usual business, then we're probably getting wrong also. You know what I'm saying?
Try again.
Just like you say we can't be cut off because of planck scale physics might affect things. But if we don't know how planck scale physics works, then there's no point in continuing our usual physics into that realm.
Well, in principle, you're right. But then there's the hope, of course, that if you have your favorite quantum gravity theory, that you may be able to test it. I mean, it could be that you hook up a theory of quantum gravity which has nonlinearities in it that, for example, translate into phenomena that would be related to turbulence. So you could have that your Planck scale physics really affects scales that are very different from the scales where gravity happens. And in that case, you could use that to, for example, rule out the theory, or in the best case, confirm. But we don't really expect this, because we expect that the linearity is a good approximation, and that comes with separation of scales. So it may be that it may in principle be that we run into problems when we put an ultraviolet cutoff, because we may be cutting off a region of the theory which actually is affecting us. But on the other hand, it could be that we cannot get away with an infrared cutoff either. In principle, this could happen. Now, when would that happen? When would it happen that we are not allowed to put the system into a box? Well, technically, at least, it can happen. For example, phase transitions formally mean that the system in question is infinite size. For example, if you have a ferromagnet and you run it to a temperature range, and you get a phase transition when spontaneously magnified, or you take a superconductor and cool it to below its critical temperature, it will spontaneously become superconductive at a point. Now, the thing is that as long as the system is of finite size, it's not really true that this happens at a point. Because as long as the system is of finite size, you have sufficient fluctuations then that things start going in and out of the phase transition before and after the critical temperature. So you only have a clean phase transition if your system in question is infinite in size. It's just a technical assumption that you have to make. You only get a discontinuity in some functions as you go through the phase transition if you have an infinite size system. Now, if for that purpose you insist on the system staying infinite in size, then in principle you prevent us from using the Stone phenomenon. And you remain to be convinced that you actually have physically to do this. That you really, I can't imagine that that an actual phase transition would have to rely on the system having to be infinitely big, because imagine how big infinitely big is. We don't have a half space. But technically, this sort of thing can happen. So that would mean that in quantum field theory, you can have unitarily non-equivalent solutions. And there may be other ways too in which you can have unitarily non-equivalent solutions, so that they would actually physically differ. There's no change of phases that makes them the same. And you may call them different phases of the same theory. And in the case of phase transitions, that may be even just the right word to use. Now, underlying the maths of non-equivalent representations, well, it's a complicated issue how that can arise, but maybe you get some intuition by looking at the following. Imagine you have two vectors, A and B, and you calculate their overlap. It comes out to be alpha, and alpha, let's assume, is real and somewhere between 0 and 1. Now, that means that A and B are not orthogonal to each other. If they were orthogonal, then their overlap would be 0. Now, take the tensor product of lots of A's and lots of B's. Remember that in quantum field theory, we have lots of mode oscillators. And this may be the state of one mode oscillator. And that may be the state of many mode oscillators. All of those mode oscillators could be in the state A, for example. So then you can ask, what's the overlap of this tensor product of all those states A with all of the tensor product of all those states B? N of those and N of these. Well, then clearly, the overlap is alpha to the power n. And if n is large, then that is a small number. Doesn't really matter. It means that A and B are not orthogonal, as long as alpha is finite. However, if you actually let n go to zero, n go to infinity, then alpha to the power n goes to zero. And for an equal infinity, you would have to conclude, I suppose, that it would be 0. Now, in principle, you have to do this mathematically much more carefully, and it's a very non-trivial business, defining the tensor product, defining infinitely many tensor products. But if you follow this naive argument, you will see that we seem to end up with concluding that this vector is orthogonal to that vector if you have infinitely many in your tensor problem, if you look at, for example, infinitely many modes. But then, if they're orthogonal to each other, then you can, for example, no longer use this vector to help linearly combine that vector. Okay, so you have now qualitatively changed things. There's a difference between orthogonality and having a little bit of a projection onto a vector. And that's, I think, at the heart of why it is that when you have infinitely many systems that you can have unitary non-equivalence where you have unitary equivalence. Now, from now on in this course, we will assume that it is actually safe to put infrared and ultraviolet cutoff so that solving for Neumann apply. And therefore, we will not worry more about this. But it's important that you keep in mind that there are these issues. Actually, there's a whole school of thought behind this that tries to avoid problems that arise from this by working not in explicit representations with Fock spaces and so on, but on a more algebraic level, where you can study the theory in a representation-independent fashion. If any one of you wants to see literature on that, I can point you to some. So from now on, we will assume that we don't run into these difficulties, and we will assume that infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs, if need be, have been taken. So that means that no matter which set of suitable mode functions we use, either this one or barred ones, double barred ones, the solutions that we obtain are always the same, up to a change of basis in the Hilbert space. for example, if we use the unbarred one, then we use the unbarred creation annihilation operators to define a vector like this, and then define this set of orthonormal vectors on top of that. And we can span the entire Hilbert space in this way. Alternatively, if we take the barred solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then we get a barred zero of a zero vector, and we build a barred set of basis vectors from it. And as we said before, those guys have to be linear combinations of these, and vice versa. Now you may wonder, does the choice of mode functions therefore not matter? Or does it? I mean, it would seem that if it's all just a matter of changing bases, why would we care? Can't we just take the next best solution that comes to mind and work with it? In principle, we can do that. In principle, it does not matter which choice of mode function we use. Because any state of the system, say psi, can always be expanded in each basis. Now, just because it's possible to use any arbitrary basis we want, doesn't mean that it's convenient to do so. And in practice, it is convenient, very convenient, to the extent that some people think it's necessary, but it's really just convenient. It is convenient whenever we know which state is the no particle in the sense of, is the vacuum state in the sense of no particle state, let's say omega, to choose the mode functions in such a way that the corresponding zero vector coincides with that. It's just very useful. So if on the basis of some other arguments that we haven't even covered yet, you find out this is the vector in the Hilbert space that describes no particles are present. If for some reason you know this vector is the one, we call it omega, then it is very convenient, so we're not necessary, it is very convenient to choose your mode function uk in such a way that the vector that's annihilated by the a, the zero, happens to be the no particle state. It's very convenient, for example, because then all those vectors that you can build on top of that by applying the creation operators will be multi-particle states then.
In Minkowski, omega would be zero.
What, this one?
Yeah.
No. In Minkowski space, the same story. There is a vector of which we know that it doesn't have particles, and then we have to find the right mode function such that this vector happens to be there. In Minkowski space, too, there's this ambiguity. Now, in Minkowski space, you may wonder, how did we identify what that state would be? And at the time, we identified it as the state of minimum energy. The state of minimum energy, the ground state, had to be the no particle state. We said that, well, in Minkowski space, there's really nothing happening. There's no reason for the energy to be elevated when there are no particles. Because it would mean that the multi-particle state would have less energy than a no particle state. That didn't seem to make sense. So we identified the vacuum state in Minkowski space as the state of minimum energy. And then, even though we didn't quite put it this way at the beginning, and then we chose the mode functions in such a way that the vector that's annihilated by the A happens to be that vector of minimum energy. As it will turn out, this procedure doesn't succeed in general. It succeeds on Minkowski space, but not in general. If you have an expanding spacetime, for example, then it's not the minimum energy state that is the no particle state. But we'll get to that in more detail, of course. So here's an outlook. It's only a rough sketch just to prepare you mentally, perhaps, for what is going to come. Say we know that the system state, psi, is the vacuum initially. Think of early universe cosmology, very early. Say we know the system starts out in the vacuum. starts out in the vacuum, and let's say we know what that state is. Perhaps by an argument similar to that of Minkowski space, maybe minimum energy state. We will see that there are a bit more sophisticated arguments for that. So let's say we have identified that initially the system is in a particular state, it is a no-particle state, and we know what vector it is in the Hilbert space. Let's assume that. Well, then it's very convenient to choose mode functions such that the corresponding zero vector is that state that we identified as being the vacuum state. And we may call this zero vector zero in. Remember that also in the driven harmonic oscillator, we had a zero in vector. Okay. Now, we work in the Heisenberg picture. So even though some evolution happens, the system is now always going to be in this state. In this state psi, in the state zero in, always. Just by definition, because we work in the Heisenberg picture. But still, things happen. The universe might be expanding, for example, or contracting or whatnot. But in any case, some evolution happens. And then after that evolution, the vacuum state may be a different state. It may be that that state in the Hilbert space, which qualifies for being called a no particle state, may now be a different vector in the Hilbert space. Let's say we call it chi at a late stage. Let's say the expansion has ended or so, just so that things become familiar again. So the situation then is that we know the system is still in this state because we are in the Heisenberg picture, it couldn't change. But the state, the vector in the Hilbert space, that vector in the Hilbert space, which rightfully can be called the no particle state, is now the vector chi. So what we can do then is we can find those mode functions whose A bar operator is annihilating a zero bar vector, which happens to be that chi. So we find those mode functions such that their zero vector happens to coincide with this thing that we identified as being a no particle state later on. So now we have two Fock bases in the game. We have the Fock bases that is generated by the unbarred A and A dagger operators corresponding to these mode functions, and we have the Fock space. By that, I mean the autonomous basis of zero vector and, you know, the excited state that comes about from choosing those mode functions and the barred creation and annihilation operators. So in order to find out whether the expansion of the space-time or whatever evolution it went through, whether this has generated particles or not, all we have to do is express this vector, the state in which the quantum field theory is in terms of the out basis, of the out Fock basis. And that will tell us exactly how many particles of what kind that we will present. And if you remember, this is going to be a calculation that's very similar in principle to how we calculated the excitation of a driven harmonic oscillator. Now, I would like to leave you with a little exercise. Recall that with respect to the Hermitian bilinear form, the complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation had this in a product. And as we saw, the Dabu basis is non-unique, therefore that basis is non-unique. Assume that we go to a new basis, barred function, by choosing this change of basis. So the new basis vectors are linear combination of the old U and the complex conjugate, both of which are needed to get the complete basis. Well, then the exercise is to show what conditions you have to impose on A and B on those change of basis matrices such that the inner product of the U bar is still the same. So what we did for the Dabu basis, do now for the basis of complex valued solutions in the Klein-Gordon equation. And then what you will find is that the A and the B matrices have to obey these two conditions. And if they do, then these solutions, in terms of the old solutions, also qualify to give us a solution to the quantum field theory. All right. That's all for today. Any questions?
And the more intricate differential geometry stuff that we need to really not worry about it, because I can't. I mean, last term's course was not good.